This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Verus Urban Politics is a hybrid seminar series hosted by the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, kicking off in the academic year 2024-25.
Hello, my name is Marian Coonahan. I'm an assistant professor at the University College Groningen. I'm a philosopher with research interests in social and political philosophy of the city, as well as social and political epistemology. The seminar series was inspired by my experiences in policy development in the urban setting.
And my name is Christian Lamker. I'm an assistant professor at the Faculty of Spatial Sciences in Groningen and co-organizing the seminar series. I'm working around sustainability, social justice, roles in planning, and future directions of post-growth planning. Here in Groningen, I also coordinate the master program Society, Sustainability and Planning.
In this seminar series, we aim to facilitate cross-disciplinary exchange between empirical studies and conceptual and normative inquiries into the political significance and potential of the urban context. The project is thus set up as a conversation between scholars from various disciplines, in particular, spatial planning, geography, urban studies, philosophy, political theory, sociology, and cultural studies, bringing together empirical and conceptual normative work addressing the political life of cities and its relevance at this critical juncture. We invite both established and emerging researchers working on topics from the above range of disciplines to share and exchange research insights, unpacking and addressing their understanding of the question, where is urban politics?
The whole series is organized by Marian Coonahan, University College Groningen, and myself, Christian Lamker, from the Faculty of Spatial Sciences. We got lots of input from Alan Trell, Malika Wilders, and Ryan Rittingslow. We are hosted by the Transitions and Social Justice Working Group at the Rudolf Agricola School for Sustainable Development in Groningen, and funded by the Young Academy Groningen SER Interdisciplinary Projects Incentive Fund.
For the first event and kickoff of the series, we invited Ross Beveridge from Glasgow and Philippe Koch from Zurich to a seminar with the theme Rediscovering Urban Politics. Ross and Philippe contributed key insights from their joint work in their book, How Cities Can Transform Democracy. We recognize their contribution on the democratic implications of urbanization as key for future debates about urban democracy, representation, and our perspectives on urban society and its spatial foundations more generally.
In particular, shelter as a fundamental human right leads to housing as one of the most difficult and most crucial topics in contemporary urban debates. With Roth and Philippe's talk, we have started our series with both theory-based conceptual thoughts and more practical implications for politics and planning.
First of all, welcome everybody. Delighted that you're here. Delighted especially to our guests. Yeah, I'll introduce you in a minute. And so what is the first seminar of our series, Where's Urban Politics? I'm Marian Coonahan from the University College Groningen.
And I'm Christian Lamker from the Faculty of Spatial Sciences.
But before we start, I thought it was just good to sort of reflect on why are we organizing this series and what do we mean with that question, just to create a little bit of maybe shared understanding, which we can come back to throughout the series. I think there are many reasons we could give why we're having this series. Some of them are more urgent, some of them are more evergreen. I'm a philosopher, so our problems tend to shift somewhat more slowly than in other disciplines. But I think we're all very aware at this point in time that democracy is certainly not a given, but a highly contingent state of affairs, which needs to be defended and maintained, and which is under threat from many angles. Maybe we're also aware in our environment that there is a seeming reemergence of urban political action, at least in the context of Dutch cities. There's been this kind of reemergence of political activism, which is very visible on city streets in the last years, after a period of seeming dormancy. But the question is, of course, broader than that. So I think before we start, it's nice to think, what is that question? How can we unpack it? Many disciplines, discourses, registers are available to us to unpack it. So very briefly, I'm going to just go through this question and think about those terms that are in it and how we can think about them. The where is urban politics? What could we mean with where? So we can think about more concretely, just spatially, the city as a built environment. What are the spaces? What are the networks? What are the sites which are claimed or used for urban politics? What are the scales? So urban politics is obviously also not only shaped by the city scale, but also, you know, regional and above that, national, supranational, even below that, the neighborhood level. But also more sort of temporally. So what are the kind of discussions? So this is more kind of conceptual. What are the kind of discussions? What are our understandings of urban politics? And how are those moving? And where do those happen in academia? So where are they being discussed in which different disciplines? And there, I think actually we've got, and I hope that the series is actually going to do this, we've got really a wide range of disciplines that talk to this question and that we would like to access. And already you guys are working in a very interesting fashion, I would say. Here are two, geographer David Harvey and philosopher Hannah Arendt, who've also really both addressed this question in their own way. Then we can look at that urban. What do we mean with the urban in urban politics? And we can think of the city as a physical space, as a built environment, which facilitates or undermines political life. But we can also think of the city as a polis, which is more like an idea of the city, which is obviously a very rich idea of the city as a sort of base site where society and politics have sort of emerged from, also sort of historically in some senses, space of appearance. That's a term from Arendt. And so here we're sort of tapping into the urban as an idea, productive idea. But we can also think of the city as a process or as an herb, as a hub for circulation, which is more entwined with our economic system, economic logics, and the attendant, for instance, environmental tolls that takes beyond the site of the urban. The idea of sort of planetary urbanization comes to the fore there. And then finally, we can think about politics. What do we mean with politics? And this has already come up in our discussions a bit this morning. The difference between politics with a sort of capital P, formal politics, local governments, policies, protests, urban planning, perhaps. This is the kind of maybe recognized politics largely, or not always, but then there's also the sort of small P political power relations, maybe even politics which is hiding, which is seemingly apolitical, where there might be stakeholders in the urban context who are not even recognized as political actors at all. All in all, a very rich question to tackle. And I think eventually we are here because we feel we need to activate urban politics because, as I think Ross and Philippe will invite us to think about, because there's potential for more engaged citizenship, for more democracy coming from this urban context, and that we need it at this time. So we are very delighted to welcome our speakers. We've got three speakers, Ross Beveridge and Philippe Koch, who will speak first, and then Darren Seerhaus. Briefly, Ross is Senior Lecturer in Urban Studies at the University of Glasgow. Philippe is Professor in Urban Politics at the School of Architecture, Design and Civil Engineering, Zurich University of Applied Sciences, but is in other roles or has lots of also experience outside of academia in politics, for instance. Darren Seerhaus is lecturer and researcher at the Hochschule of Amsterdam and is doing his PhD on the dynamics around urban development, especially in these kind of sustainability challenges and urban innovation labs which arise around that. Back to Ross and Philippe, we've invited you here because you've published this wonderful wide-ranging book, How Cities Can Transform Democracy. And quoting from you, you argue that urbanization is generative of a different rationality of political engagement and with that a different democratic vision. So we very much look forward to hearing about this democratic vision and how we can realize it, of course. So I'd like to hand over the floor to you.
So first of all, thanks to Marion and Christian for the really generous invitation. So Philip and I will be doing this as a kind of a double act, with less jokes than a normal double act. So as Mary said, this is largely based on a book we wrote recently and an article we published, Seeing Democracy Like a City. And in some ways, it's quite theoretical. Although it's based on our readings of what happens in cities, our readings of urban politics, essentially. To make that bit more graspable, I'm going to give you kind of the ending in a way at the beginning. So there are two thrusts running through the presentations, running through the book and art. So the first one is related to democracy, and it's related to this idea in particular that we might have misplaced the idea of democracy, or we might have lost the original idea and meaning of democracy. In particular, we might have forgotten that democracy, or we might have been distracted by some of the state-based discussions of democracy, might have distracted us from realizing that democracy should be something that's embedded or close to our everyday lives. So democracy should be something that is close to our social lives. So that's one thrust in relation to all the crises going around with democracy. So the original idea of democracy was going in this direction. The second thrust relates to urbanization. So if the first one's a bit more about political theory, the second part of it's much more to do with geography, planning and that kind of thing. So urbanization, for many geographers, many political economists, is the driving force, a global force. So as well as transforming landscapes and cities, as we will discuss briefly, it's also, we argue, transforming politics. Marin, you mentioned a resurgence of urban politics. And we would argue that urbanization provides a way of thinking about lots of the political practices which we've seen emerge. There's a politics of urbanization, not just a politics of an urban politics per se. There's a politics related to urbanization as a process which connects places as well as shaping specific cities. And so the connection between these two parts, these two thrusts, the democracy bit and the urbanization bit, is the city. So the city, or whatever the city is, and there's obviously some discussion what a city is. In our view, the city is the name or the location for democracy within a context of urbanization. So a way of thinking about how we can bring democracy closer or indeed into people's everyday lives in a context of global urbanization. So that's the kind of rough frame. Let's see if and how we can get to that argument. So I'm going to start with an example. So I said it was quite theoretical, but I'm going to start with an example. Cambridge Street protest in May 2021. Now, what happened in this protest? It was a dawn raid. It was a Sunday morning, you know, a typical time for the immigration services to do a raid. And they took two men originally from India who'd been living in Glasgow for quite a long time, but without permanent residence. So they were taken from one of the flats, one of the apartments in the building here, into the van. And in the time that it took to get them out of the property, through word of mouth, through connections between activist groups in the area, this area has quite a strong activist scene, people came out onto the street. It's a very diverse area as well. So lots of people came out to the street to find out what was going on. They heard what was happening. Someone was getting taken away. And essentially they blocked the immigration enforcement van in the middle. So it was a kind of a spontaneous moment. Spontaneous, but also including lots of planning, of course, because activist networks plan and talk to each other. And so people came, so from other parts around the city, as quickly as they could, as well as the rest. So essentially the people in the van, the two men who were due to be taken away, were blocked inside the van, and the van itself couldn't move. The police were then called. And you can see the police were encircling the van. And everyone's wearing masks. It was during COVID, during the lockdown. And at some point, the van couldn't move forward or backwards. The police decided that they would have to release the two men, return them to their property, because there was a COVID situation, it was a public health situation. It was too dangerous to have people congregating in the street because of the risk of the spread of COVID virus. So essentially, this was then led to huge celebrations. There was a massive, and this negotiation went on for an hour or 2 hours or something. There were rumors that the First Minister of Scotland also called and told the police to let them go. And this was celebrated, of course, by the activist groups, immigration support networks, and most people lived in the area. It's a great kind of victory for some kind of democracy. I mean, you can see in this picture, we see some of the key questions that democratic theories always address, going back to ancient Greece and Athens. So is this a mob, unruly people threatening the state, or is this the demos, the people, the rightful force of democracy exerting their rule? And if this is the demos, where does it begin and end? Does it end at the end of the street? Where does it begin and how long should it last? And what kind of issues is it raising? And what kind of city demanding? We have the conflict between borders being enforced by the immigration service. And we had demands, placards and things about no borders, don't take my neighbors. So it's appeals to kind of a kind of form of global society within the city, indeed within this area of Glasgow. And who is the state? Is the state this singular sovereign force? The immigration service essentially overruled by the police. Police reversed the decision of the immigration service in this case. So for us, it was already raising lots and lots of questions. In the aftermath of this, when there's kind of celebratory feeling, of course, it was great that these two men from India were allowed to stay, at least initially. Pina Aksu from the Mary Hill Integration Network, which is a kind of asylum seekers support network within Glasgow, said they messed with the wrong city. She was referring to the immigration service. So when she said that, she was really appealing to self-understanding that lots of Glaswegians have. And you can find in other cities, of course, as well. But there's a certain view that Glasgow is as a kind of rebellious place, a place that has really rich, particularly leftist politics. Our rent strikes during the First World War was the last time the British Army was used on mainland Britain in a political protest. It was Winston Churchill who put the tanks in the streets in Glasgow to quell the rent strikes, people demanding rent caps, essentially. Housing crisis. Couldn't afford to pay their rents. The workers' movement, was a big industrial city, Glasgow, particularly around the docks. There's this kind of charismatic figure there of Jimmy Reid, trade unionist, talking to the workers down at the docks. And this is called Red Clydeside, and Red Clydeside, make Red Clydeside red again. So this is one invocation of what the city could be. So when Peter Axe was saying they mess with the wrong city, she's tapping into these ideas of the place. But of course, it's not the only image of a city or a place. There's never one singular, steady, stable thing to be invoked. And of course, in the weeks immediately after this incident with the immigration services and leading up to the last few weeks, we've had increasing right-wing protests, as we've had in other parts of the UK and Europe. And this is a very different kind of Glasgow that they're invoking. So this is raising the question, so the city seems to have this productivity. People are really talking about, wow, it can be a force or something, but this is a contested force. Now, whose city? Who does it belong to? Why should we be interested in it? So these are some of the questions that we were trying to grapple with when we were writing the book. And Marion's already referred to some of the wider context, why we might need to do that. You know, there is a visible felt crisis of established liberal democracy for at least a decade, perhaps longer. Really is a question of how far democracy is compatible with capitalism. And there is a question of what the state has in that context. Can we turn to the state? Is there a way to return to the state, perhaps the welfare state, some kind of idealized image of the state 30 or 40 years ago? Is that the way to save democracy in the face of the multiple challenges that it's now encountering? Or are there other ways of thinking about democracy, rethinking democracy? Is there a different project of democracy, one linking into the way politics is already happening? That's where we take it up, I suppose. And then we start to ask this question, okay, if people are talking about the city, invoking the city in political struggles, how do we think that through as a form of democracy, as a form of policy? First question is the city a real thing in the context of all these global flows, these blurring between a countryside and city? How do urbanites actually engage the city as a project of democracy? What kind of practices are there? What can we see? Are there patterns? Some kind of emerging vision of an alternative form of politics related to the city? What might be the implications of that? So if we start thinking in relation to political theory, the Greek polis is obviously an obvious place to start. It's often seen in terms of this the city, this place of the city being almost synonymous with the state. So one interpretation is that democracy and politics comes from this the presence of the state in the city. City and the state are together. One word with a hyphen. Another reading of that, this is a reading provided by a Canadian political theorist, Warren Magnuson, was that even in these writings, and this is, we'll come back to Aristotle, Plato, all these kind of periods, these interpretations of it, they're missing something about this period, about all forms of urban politics. Politics, the political character of places, of cities, isn't an effect, an outcome of the state's presence. It's an outcome of the urban condition, urban ways of life, urban contexts. Politics doesn't emanate from a sovereign force. Of course, the state is a political presence. It doesn't, it's not the source necessarily of the democratic character of the city. So it's possible to start separating the city from the state, or not making democracy dependent on the state. Now, if we start dealing with questions of where the city ends and begins, is the city, if the city isn't the state, if this is about jurisdictions and boundaries, spatial or administrative or whatever, what is the city then? This is kind of the three of the main ways we address that in our book. We do it in a negative way and then in a positive way. So the city is not a political jurisdiction where we find new democratic models for an urban age. So we can't go back to the age of the city-states, whether that's Athens or it's medieval Europe or whatever. Can't go back to a period where the state and the city are in unison together. The city is also not a distinct social spatial form for the urban society to reinvent democracy. Urbanization, these churning processes, these links between places challenge an idea of a sovereign state form being able to control a particular space. But a city is, and is often in practice, a political imaginary to articulate and situate democratic practices in publics and places. So this idea of the city is theoretically grounded in the idea of the city as a category of practice. So in plainer terms, we understand the city or the urban in the way in which it is practiced and lived. So in the way in which it is represented and made sense of, even enacted by people who live in cities, by urbanized themselves. The city is still an idea. It has its resonance because it is linked to political theory, because it's linked to political moments of the past. It still can mobilize people in very particular local ways, the idea of a particular city like Glasgow or the idea of the city. And thus, the city is a way to localize and situate claims for democracy and democratic action. So the city, rather than the state, or perhaps the nation, or it can be seen as another imaginary around which democracy can be organized and located. If we look across urban theory as a whole, if you try to take a look across the state of urban research, you know, it's an interdisciplinary field, of course, we see across the different disciplines of urban studies, sociology, geography, politics, and also from different theoretical perspectives, political economy, Marxist, neo-Marxist perspectives, as well as post-structural cultural perspectives, diverse strands that really point to and indeed are already reimagining politics or providing different languages and registers for political action in relation to the urban. So there's a form of urbanization of politics occurring already. So we have Julian Boudreau, a sociologist, urban sociologist, who writes about an urban logic of political action, which is networked. It's decentered, a generative kind of networks connecting people in interest. We have urbanity as a mode of being political, this Warren Magnuson argument that being in urban space, occupying urban space, creates forms, registers, modes of being political, different to national politics. I think of Abdul Malik Simon writing particularly about the South, the global South, the cities there is having this self-governing capacity where we talk about context where the state isn't very, isn't as present or isn't as visible as a political force. some kind of organized, disorganized dynamic through which collectives come together. And then in a more political economy, neo-Lefebvrian perspective, we see capitalism driving contradictions which take material spatial form. They become visible in cities, clashes of interest, and generally these create inequalities, of course they do, but through these inequalities, differential urbanization can emerge. This is the idea that spaces of opportunity emerge within inequalities that capitalism produces. So there's a range of literature there, providing us with tools by which we can reimagine politics, potentially also democracy, in very urban ways. I think at that point, I'm going to hand over to Philippe.
Hello, everybody, from my side. The second part of my part is really trying to connect those two threads that Ross set out at the beginning. What Ross already invoked is that in our research and writing, we are mainly interested in urbanization as a democratic question. There are democratic possibilities that urbanization provides, and there are different ways that these possibilities are put into action and how they are related to everyday life and the built environment. By urbanization, we mean a multifaceted process that shape and transform land, territories, and spatial practices. It is linked to more general or abstract systems and strategies of the economy, state regulations, and international bureaucracies. At the same time, urbanization is always anchored in situated everyday life, struggles over concrete realizations of spatial projects and lived space. And the other term, democracy, we understand democracy as a project or political struggle rather than an institutional framework. Arrangements of collective self-government are democratic to the extent that they embody an ethos which strives for equality through the articulation of and actions towards common concerns and demands. An urban logic of democracy is a process of advancing self-government through and for urban collectives claiming their right to the city to access, enjoy, co-produce, and benefit from urban space and urban life. So how does urbanization change democracy? Urbanization seems like an unlikely choice to begin to kind of flourish democracy. Urbanization seems to undermine rather than foster common understandings of democracy. The dynamics of urbanization, the forces of creative destruction linked to urbanization, are the causes of most of the pressing problems of humanity. Energy consumption, destruction of environment, access and use of resources and public infrastructures. The usual way, at least in urban political science, is to look at the relation between urbanization and democracy, to ask how democracy can shape and organize urbanization. In much research, urbanization is conceived first and foremost as a problem of territorial governance and regulation, as urbanization undermines or ignores existing political jurisdictions and makes it thus more difficult to find the steering capacity and political legitimacy necessary to address or even plan processes of spatial transformation. But as urban theory suggests, the literature that Ross was referring to, urbanization has implications for democracy. There are tensions imminent to urbanization, a tension between the social material urbanity that urbanization induces, the proximity of things, people from different backgrounds, the clashes of different technologies and knowledges, and the will of public authorities and administrative forces to tame or regulate this urbanity. Another tension is that between the urban form, the materiality of urbanization, the urban everyday life, the sociability of unlikely spaces, the encounters embedded in the urban form. Urbanization changes the site, the source, and the stake of democracy, we claim. It changes the ways it is enacted and practiced. We see multiple authorities aiming for and claiming self-government. We see that people engage with the material world around them, and we see urban collective life situated in the everyday as a site of politics. The source is a politics of social, spatial, material proximity grounded in local ambitions and knowledges and bodily practices. The stake is to access and to co-create the immediate urban environment. We think that herein lies the democratic horizon and meaning of urbanization, to have access to participate, to enjoy the benefits of urbanization and differential space as collective project and common property. Or as Parcel puts it, quote, if the spatial project of democracy is bound up with the production of differential space, then it must be also bound up with the questions of the urban and urban space. Democracy becomes then the project of urban inhabitants, in particular using their power to produce and manage urban space themselves. End of quote. In this view, urban democracy is not about the relation between states and citizens, but between people and the places they inhabit. In an earlier paper, we argued that there are at least three ways in which democracy is practiced in relation to urban space, beyond the usual institutionalized ways of democracy. And in the next few minutes, I will provide an example around housing, which kind of relates all three ways of how collective urban life kind of articulates democracy. And this example should really emphasize the need to think of democratic practices as embodied and material, to shift to more mundane locations of everyday life, and to foreground the spatial and political quality of the built environment. The example is around cooperatives in Uruguay and Switzerland. And not only there, but housing has become an intense field of urban struggle, at least since the financial meltdown of 2008. In the aftermath of the global financial crisis, activists and scholars have increasingly turned to collective forms of housing as a strategy for the decommodification of housing. In our study, we argue that housing cooperatives as a collective form of housing are potentially powerful instruments to expand the use value of housing. The examples emphasize the embeddedness in urban everyday life and the alternative vision of a property regime to enable a different democratic politics through re-relating urban society to urban form. Switzerland and Uruguay are internationally recognized as frontrunners in cooperative housing. They emerge as bottom-up, both of them emerge as bottom-up social movements with strong connections to trade. Umbrella organizations and state support in both countries played a crucial role. In both countries, there are different types of cooperatives, but the vast majority continue to adhere to core values and principles, such as collective ownership of non-commodifiable housing, participation and democracy, which is a requirement for accessing public support. In Uruguay, the housing cooperative movement is a vital political agent influencing electoral politics and public policies that provided crucial support for progressive governments to get elected. The history of the Uruguayan case also highlights an interesting conceptual point. Facing a hostile political environment during the military dictatorship, the cooperative movement reinforced their political purpose and expanded their commitment towards the members and towards the wider public. Thus, the case of Uruguay is an interesting one of cooperatives actively resisting state coercion. The political role of Swiss housing cooperatives is less impressive, as members of housing cooperatives are first and foremost reliable constituencies for social democratic parties and instrumental to establish and maintain also ties between governments, political parties, and working middle-class residents. So kind of a case of usual institutionalized political organizations, similar to a political party or NGO. And in contrast to the highly politicized housing cooperative movement in Uruguay, the Swiss case shows that over time, the close ties to the public administration and their important role in the implementation of the city housing and urban development policies contributed to a depoliticization of many housing cooperatives. In fact, most housing cooperatives settle for their existing housing stock and residents and don't consider in their mission to contribute to the provision of affordable housing in general to a wider public outside of their membership. However, this depoliticization has become an object of recurrent struggle and triggered an ongoing process of repoliticization. Urban social movements have been starting to reconceptualize housing as a right to live in the city, but also as a place for new forms and modes of social reproduction and community organization. Housing cooperatives have been discovered as established organizations to experiment with new forms of living. Through this repoliticization and appropriation of the organizational model of housing cooperatives, they are currently re-emerging as political arm actors and a form of collective urban life. In both countries, the principal goal of housing cooperatives is to renegotiate property regimes in relation to urban inhabitants and urban society, and to turn the housing stock into a commons and bring it under the control of a public commons partnership. Seen in such terms, housing cooperatives are aiming for the decommodification of housing and bring key urban resources under the control of self-governance. What is interesting in current housing struggles in different places around the globe is that the question of property is raised once again. The study on housing cooperatives in Switzerland and Uruguay shows alternative ways to conceptualize property, not only as a relation between a property holder and its property, but a relation between different humans and social groups to access, enjoy, and co-produce urban space. Property in a cooperative sense is not here to exclude other potential users, but to enable the commons and to broaden the access to the urban commonwealth. Struggling for a home is thus more than an attempt to fulfill private choices. Rather, it is a way to relate oneself as a person or collective to the wider social material world. In its attempt to overcome exclusion and alienation, it seeks to facilitate resonance in urban collective life through the alignment of people, materials, and space. It can be a means to overcome the power relation inscribed in the materiality and sociability of the city, and to re-establish a form of connection and resonance with the environment. It is one mode of locating democratic politics and infrastructure of self-government. For finishing off, I'll hand it over back to Ross.
What does that example imply for approaching democracy? Well, the first strand of thinking can relate to a contradiction or tension between political practices and political institutions, and how they relate to the health of the thriving nature or not of democracy. In this urban view of politics, as politics is actually happening in the cities around us, practicing on urban space, doing democracy, seem incredibly important, if not fundamental to an urban vision of democracy. Institutions, although of course fundamental to any way of thinking about the longevity of a project, perhaps, are very ambivalent in terms of their relationship to a democratic project based on doing democracy. And that in particular leads to an ambivalence around the state. Not necessarily an anarchist rejection of the state, but a decentering of the state and a question mark behind the state. What do we want the state to do? Rather than being the sovereign source of democracy, can we ask if the state should be doing performing other kind of roles in relation to democratic projects? So alongside that, of course, we see in the various examples that we mentioned in the book, there's housing cooperatives and other ones we have, there's entanglements driven by urbanization, the complexity of modern urban life, which ignore jurisdictions, bring places together in interesting, peculiar, sometimes awkward ways. Place and materiality is important to the way people feel about themselves as political agents, to becoming a political agent. It's not something which can be abstracted from politics or the ideal of democracy as it has tended to be. It's not an accidental background, a stage upon which real politics happens. Places and material context matter. So alongside that, urban publics, so publics emerging, bubbling up, not necessarily in relation to the state, become a source of political subjectivity. This is an idea of becoming a democratic citizen through doing democracy, not through formalized rights of citizenship. political subjects emerge through political practices. It's one implication of the arguments we are making. If you think there's lots of implications and questions in relation to that, to those kind of arguments, of course, but here are a couple that we think are quite important and pertinent. In this view of democracy as being something which is embedded in collective life and everyday life, the knowledges which play a role or which should play a role in democratic politics are quite different. They're much more locally based, place-based. They can be experiential, things that are felt. And they emerge again in relation to practices. So that implies, of course, that democracy is always situated. It always has a context. It's always based upon a set of practices within the wider context of political action. So final question, which that might prompt is then, the question is not then to ask how urbanites can participate in political processes, but how planners can join in the production of urban space that citizens are already carrying out and performing themselves. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.